Thanks, David. It's a download here on 720 WGN. It's time to reload this past week's news. What's the biggest story? The winners, the losers, overreported, underreported. Which story sucked us down the rabbit hole? And, of course, which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 100, 500 years from this week? Let's get into it. Heather Sharone is here, City Hall reporter for DNA Info. Good to see you, Heather.
Thanks, Justin.
Ray Long, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune in studio as well. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to be here, buddy.
Good to have the dream team back together again here. 312-981. High five. 312-981-7200 if you want to play tonight. Text, phone calls if you want to get in the conversation. The lines are open. All right, so let's start with the biggest story of the week. I mean, I think we all agree the shooting in Virginia takes the cake as the number one story, a story that, of course, has a lot of implications in it. Your first thoughts on this week's, that being the biggest story?
I just, you know, we were talking a little bit before we went on that it just became incredibly politicized almost immediately. And I think part of the reason was that we had the president say that Congressman Steve Scalise was not going to die, that he was out of danger, when in fact we learned, you know, late yesterday and today that he was in very, very critical condition. And it was a sobering reminder for me, especially as a journalist who sort of sometimes has to focus on, okay, was anybody killed? Okay, yeah. No, okay, let's move on. But that the damage of a shooting can't just be measured in fatalities, but also in injuries. And it's important to realize that, you know, a gunshot can have a lasting impact on a person's life, even if it isn't fatal, especially now that we know that he was shot in the hip. And that's, my mom's a nurse, so I know, you know, that that's a very, yeah, very dangerous place to
and
get it, shot.
And I mean, Ray, it's an interesting point because, you know, not even just the president with his tweets saying he's gonna be okay, and I think it was Donald Trump Jr. who came out, who right away made it political. I mean, it's got politics at the center of this, and it's going to come out, and there's going to be a conversation about it. But there always seems to be a little bit of wait time to make sure that people, you know, that if they're in critical condition and they could be life-threatening injuries, that is sort of honored. And in this case, the president almost jumped that and took that away from Scalise.
Yeah, there's this kind of Twitter society we live in here where everybody's looking for the next headline even before it's written or punched into Twitter. It's just a fast moving pace, and I think they deflated a very serious situation out there where the congressman was still going through surgery and it was in critical condition. It's also kind of deflating to see that there's not the same type of resonance after prior terrible shootings, like we've seen efforts to try to push gun control, for example, or just the gun debate has not completely erupted like you would anticipate it would. Or if you had just thought, hey, there's a congressman who just got shot, you know, you would think that there might have been instant calls for gun control like you've seen in the past.
Yeah, and it really did feel like the heart of the argument and debate went was to political rhetoric and the news media.
Yeah, it did. And what I think was interesting to me, at least, was that immediately it went to motive and, you know, what sort of politics was this guy
right.
motivated from?
Right. They went to his Facebook page, and, things
right.
like that.
Yeah. And, you know, as a reporter, it's amazing that we now have these sort of bread, virtual breadcrumbs where we can see what he posted about and what he said about it and that sort of thing. But, you know, I was really struck by a tweet from Glenn Thrush, who's one of the White House reporters for The New York Times. And he sort of said, look, this is a fact, not an opinion. You know, Trump has, you know, by any definition, benefited from this sort of enraged political climate more than any other politician, you know, sort of in America, and that he's done more to sort of tap into that. And that, you know, he suggested that we as a society have to grapple with sort of the after effects. And I, you know, heard a couple of people say, you know, oh, well, you know, somehow the guards that we had in our political discourse have some sort of come down, because I, you know, I go to a gym 3 or 4 times a week and there's always the guy who's got Fox News and getting red in the face, or, you know what I mean? Like we
tell
all...
me which gym you're at so I can avoid you.
You know, but you know, how have we gotten to a society where we take as a, like a reasonable string of events that you watch, you know, cable news, and you get so angry and you buy a gun and you target a congressman.
Well, I mean, there has been I mean, it was interesting that there has been a push and sort of a blame put on the left. This idea that the left has they've done this anti-Trump bias in newspapers, the mainstream media has made it all about how terrible Trump is. This is bound to happen. Breitbart even talked a little bit about, you know, it's different than the situation with Giffords because that was a mentally disturbed person. This was politically motivated. There really is this push to, even though the story that we all, I think we all really want to come out is, can this be a push for political unity? There still seems to be those on both sides of the aisle that want to divide.
Right. There's division, but you want to see them come together. You know, you even had Nancy Pelosi and Paul Ryan sitting together doing an interview on TV for the first time they'd actually done a joint interview. But when you dig down past that, there are still the positions that they're dug into on the various issues that separate us as a country. And so we're not going to see a solution to this whole shooting epidemic that we have in the country. We're going to see everybody shrink back into their original positions, but call for more civil discourse. And, you know, it really hasn't gotten much more civil.
Can I give you my pet peeve about this whole thing?
Yeah.
That every time we have a mass shooting or some sort of incident like this, we learn a couple days later that the perpetrator had a history of domestic violence. And it was true in this gentleman's case, and it was true in pretty much every mass shooter going back, you know, for, as far as I can
remember. It's alarming to when those stories come out that that's really seems to be the thread that connects them all.
And so, you know, from what I've read and, you know, heard, it's clear that this was not a mentally stable person. You know, and of course, our gun laws allow, you know, him to buy a gun. That's by all accounts, they were bought legally. And, you know, when you are sort of unstable in this environment, you know, what role does that play?
Right.
And I just, you know, on a personal note, not a, you know, sort of a reporter hat, but I wish there was more talk of how, you know, you know, if you engage in violence against those around you, you are more likely to engage in violence on a widespread scale. And I don't think that we're able as a society to grapple with that. And it's frustrating.
Heather Sharon, Ray Long in studio. We're talking about this week's news. 312-981-7200. All right, here's what we're going to do. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll get into winners, losers, overreported, underreported, and keep the train running. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading this week's news with Heather Sharon and Ray Long, 312-981-7200. All right, let's get to the winners and losers. We'll start with winners. A big story today. Let's get right to it. I mean, Amazon purchasing Whole Foods. I have to put Amazon in the category of winner. This is a big move for Amazon, who has been searching for essentially a way to compete. I read this whole story today about how they want to compete with Walmart, and Walmart's got the leg up because of the brick and mortar stores. Well, maybe not so much anymore.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real change in the landscape, and you don't expect Amazon to be doing that. That's what I think everybody was caught by surprise about. And so, you know, I'm starting to envision, you know, are we going to get sweet potatoes and oranges delivered by a drone once Amazon plays out its full platter here?
Well, I wasn't a Prime member until I had my first daughter. And then, you know, if you've ever had to haul a kid, you know, out in the cold and then out of the car and then into the car, you know, will pray at the shrine of Jeff Bezos, you know, any day of the week. So, you know, I get that he wants, you know, to find another fish hook into us, and you know, God love it if, you know, it includes sweet potatoes.
Yep.
I'll be ordering.
Well, Susie Schmidt said that was talking about this on Rokan, but also read today, you know, Amazon has done a tremendous job with Amazon Prime to really corner the market. They had something like 60% of people using this any sort of delivery service are using Amazon Prime. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but where are they running into the issue, and I found this fascinating, was where they get beat is Walmart has the low income shopper.
Right. And you saw Prime earlier or last week saying that if you are on government assistance, if you get food stamp assembly, you get a Prime membership for free, which, you know, I think is, you know, clearly shows what they're trying to
do. Well, critics and I would say Wall Street as well. I mean, the pushback, and I think it's a real eye opener, you know, as stocks went down today for a lot of the retailers and suppliers. Because one thing that's kind of famously known about Walmart is they will force suppliers to push the price down. They're going to lose in the long run. If Amazon is competing with Walmart through Whole Foods or whatever, do we get to a certain point where they fix the price, everybody else goes with it because they're trying to get to the customers that are out there, and you're going to see the retail economy suffer?
Yeah, I think you do. And I think you get into this whole wage consideration argument, too. If you're going to have lower prices, then you're going to be paying people less and less to work for you, too. You know, it's kind of do you wonder, are they going to start paying you to get their product? It's just a thing that could spiral out of control very quickly.
That's an interesting story. So I had that for winners. The other winner I had, and a story we obviously, it was a huge story and would have been a lot bigger if it wasn't for the shooting in Virginia, was about everything that's happening with the investigation into Russia. Jeff Sessions, who I have in the loser category, but he was on in front of the Senate committee this week. And Robert Mueller, I mean, seems very strange, but the president has gone out of his way through other friends and others to say that, you know, Robert Mueller, the special investigator appointed by the Department of Justice, is on the chopping block, that they want to fire him.
Yeah, it's like the Saturday massacre in slow motion or something like that, because you've got Mueller, who is well-respected.
A war hero. Both, a straight-up war hero.
Yeah, both sides of the aisle, you know, good resume, all kinds of things that you want. And then all of a sudden, Trump's starting to attack him, too. It just raises everybody's suspicions that he's trying to cover up for something really
now,
big.
I kind of made this joke yesterday with the carryout, but I mean, I look at it this way, and it's a very strange way to think, but
that's why we love you.
Yeah. But I mean, in defense of Trump, if the FBI director has told him there is no investigation, you're not under investigation, there is no connection to collusion, he is right in the idea that what is he obstructing? Like the idea, like, what is the obstruction of justice? And then he goes, that's where he might take it too far. Where he's like, witch hunt, all caps, the whole bit. Yeah. But the idea that he sees it as, I was never under investigation, so there's nothing to obstruct.
Well, you don't. I mean, for example, if my good friend Ray was under investigation from the Chicago Police Department, and I like Ray, I, you know, don't want him to go to jail. If I, you know, destroy evidence, or if I, you know, otherwise hinder the investigation, I can be charged with obstruction of justice. And now, I was never in any legal jeopardy by Ray's malfeasance.
True,
which
true.
I,
that's a good
you
point.
Know,
yeah.
So you don't have to be under investigation to obstruct justice.
And that's I think what he's. He knows that, but he's manipulating with Twitter to make it seem like.
And we should be clear that when the president asked James Comey, am I under investigation, would you make a public statement to that? The question was in regard to was he under counterintelligence espionage investigation, which is a very specific sort of investigation. Mm-hmm. And when you investigate an American citizen for espionage, essentially, you have to open up a formal file, and there's a whole process because there's a whole, you know, litany of constitutional rights that have to be protected. No one ever sort of really thought Trump was a Russian spy. I mean, maybe some people do. I don't think that's reasonable. But for him to now say that was sort of a blanket, you didn't do anything wrong, I think is what you're saying is where he sort of takes it that next step.
Well, I mean, Ray, when we talk about obstruction of justice, you've covered both have covered politics. But I mean, when you talk about the things that we know from what was under oath with James Comey talking about, you know, Flynn's a good guy, things like that. I mean, is there enough there for an investigation to get at a president about obstructing justice?
Well, it would be hard to convict somebody with just that, if that's all you've got. But you have enough other fire or smoke out there to think that there is fire to look into. And most likely, that exchange has brought some people out of the woodwork to say, you know, there's this and this and this. You know, who knew that Comey had put down all of his conversations with Trump in email form, or and just had it all recorded, just so there would be a historic record about it. So they've got to pick this apart. And remember, it's always the cover up that seems to get you.
It always is, man. All right, the one thing I was again like trying to think about this story, and it kind of, as you think about it, blows my mind that we are willing to accept as the American people this strange narrative that Donald Trump doesn't know what he's doing. The idea that he's not a politician. So when he talks to Comey or he's talking to Jeff Sessions, he doesn't say the right things. I forgot who it was, but a congressman came out yesterday and said he doesn't have the language discipline. That's what his crime is. I wonder, and I'm surprised that he hasn't pushed back because he's proven to be vain. It's an insult. But I don't see him as an ignorant guy to the ways of the way business or politics works. He knows what he's doing. He knows about investigations. He's a multimillionaire, if not billionaire, who's dealt with SEC investigations and others. I mean, he understands this stuff. So it kind of blows my mind that's sort of the political argument, the narrative that seems to be pushed forward.
Especially when we've had, I don't know how many months of Republicans, you know, hammering Hillary Clinton for her purported misdeeds and, you know, lack of ethical clarity. And it's, you know, I cannot imagine a world where Paul Ryan says, well, she didn't really know what she was doing.
Right.
And of course, that was essentially Hillary Clinton's defense. Look, I set up an email server because I wanted
to. Nobody believed her.
I wanted it to be easier. I wanted it to be, you know, better for my staff. That was what she said,
right.
But she does not get that benefit of
the
doubt.
And to be fair, I mean, people even on the left don't believe her in
sure.
that
yeah.
regard. I mean, it's not like that everyone's like, oh, Hillary.
Yeah.
But in this case, yeah, it seems like there seems to be this prevailing notion that we're all supposed to believe that President Trump, he just doesn't know Washington.
Yeah, I think he doesn't know Washington, for one thing, but I do think that it's selling him short to think that he doesn't know how to deal with people behind closed doors, because he's made a life business. That's his world, dealing with people behind closed doors. What I think we're seeing here is, though, a guy who can't really handle the scrutiny when it's driven down to, yes, this is right, no, this is not. He just can't tell the truth and the falsehoods, and he thinks that people will just buy what he says.
Ray Long, Heather Sharone in studio. We're talking winners and losers this week as we reload the week's news. 312-981-7200. Let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news with David. We'll come back. We'll do losers. There's a lot of losers. We want to talk about some local stuff too. Ray, Heather, stay with us. Thanks, David. Download here, 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Heather Sharone, City Hall reporter for DNA Info. And Ray Long, the investigative reporter over at the Chicago Tribune, are in studio with me tonight. Also, we are accepting your texts and calls tonight. Let's go to the line. 773 says, truth. Remember Hillary Clinton, Obama, media has tunnel vision. Only those who are liberal mindset. That's what they're saying. And they said they go into reference. And the reason, and you guys never harped on Hillary's deleting emails, obstruction of justice. And Trump's extremely bright, not a politician or a member of that club. And again, thanks for that comment. I do think that we have a little bit of revisionist history in the way that Hillary Clinton's emails have been covered. And I would even say is the reason she did not win the election. So the idea that somehow that part is always less, that's out of the equation when they talk about, what about Hillary's emails? Yeah, her obstruction of justice cost her the 2016 presidential election. Am I wrong on that? I mean, it felt like up to this point, everyone will say that Hillary Clinton was a more accomplished and experienced politician. She's there, but the question remained on whether or not she had done something wrong with her emails. She had covered up. She had lied. She's a liar. Therefore, I don't want to vote for her. So she ultimately got her punishment.
Yeah, I can't say that's the sole reason that she lost. I think her strategy was flawed. I think if you're out there trying to win Arizona when you haven't locked down Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, you've got a problem, or Ohio or whatever. But I do think that people remember what they want to remember, just as they watch what they feel comfortable hearing on TV, or they listen to what they want, or they'll say that this story that is truth, in fact, is wrong because it's fake news because they disagree with it. So you've got a real interesting mixture out there. This is not your parents' electorate that's out there.
But, I mean, the idea, even when you hear about the obstruction of justice, even from from Trump on Twitter, where he's talking about what about Hillary's emails, what about Loretta Lynch and this meeting, that was widely covered.
It was
editorialized.
Absolutely.
And it showed through polls and facts and all of that that it had a dent. And ultimately, she lost the election.
And there's a significant amount of evidence out there that even now would show that Hillary would have won the election had James Comey not felt the need to at least reinvestigate the emails that were found on Anthony Weiner's laptop toward the end of the election, which, you know, would not have happened had there not been an investigation. And James Comey has been quite clear in saying that he probably wouldn't have made the July statement where he said that Hillary Clinton would not face charges had Loretta Lynch not met with former President Clinton on the tarmac. So there's a whole line of dominoes that were covered extensively, not just as they happened, but put in context. It's disingenuous to say that, you know, Hillary Clinton skated through somehow on these charges of less than ethical behavior.
If the American people believe, and I mean, think about it, if Hillary Clinton was president right now, And there was another thing that came out with the emails, and the House and the Senate both are Republicans. She wouldn't even be president at this point. We would already be in watching her leave in a impeachment. I mean, the it's just, you know, that the case. So the idea, I think, the takeaway for me is that I think it truly is, when you talk about issues of obstruction of justice and politicians in Washington, a bipartisan approach where we are seeing both parties do things that are in their own interest and continue to essentially, you know, allegedly break the law when it comes to obstructing justice. And I think that you have to take it case by case. It can't be, but the other side does it. I mean, what are we, fourth graders?
Yeah.
You know, you get to a certain point that way.
Right. If you go down to the Clinton Library in Little Rock, you'll see their little section about the impeachment. And it is all spin. It is all about their spin of it. I think what the Hillary email situation did was actually reinforced this idea that there's always something about everything that's happening that the Clintons do that just doesn't add up right. And people are always kind of questioning it. And I think that just, like I said, reinforced those doubts that people had.
I went to Northwestern. I have almost a double major in American history. And, you know, so I wrote a lot about this before I was a full-time journalist. And, you know, it's important to remember that dating back to the 1960s, Hillary Clinton was the rights bugaboo for feminism and women's rights and leftist politics. And then when she, you know, became Hillary Clinton and wasn't Hillary Rodham anymore, and, you know, that this just, you know, a decades-long effort by right, you know, politicians to paint her as something un-American and, you know, on the far side, evil and sort of at least up to no good.
You know what? And I got to say, and I think history repeats itself in the way that the right is saying the same thing about Donald Trump and how the left is trying to paint him. This idea that there is always political forces in trying to paint the other side. And we've seen it throughout history. So when you hear President Trump say things like, I'm the most unfair, you know, a president and are treated the most unfair of any president in history. That's a big statement because this is happening all the time in our history.
Yeah,
this is every side, every politician. All right, let's go to something we can all agree on, local politics.
Right?
Let's talk about
no controversy there.
Yeah, no controversy. Let's go to the loser category. And one, the mayor of Chicago had a tough week, mostly around the idea of this consent decree. We had seen police reform on the table all last year. We saw the Department of Justice get involved. We saw a scathing report. We were assured there was going to be a consent decree. New president comes in, new Department of Justice head in Jeff Sessions, new FOP president. And the mayor comes out and says, we don't need a consent decree. I think what we'll do is we'll just do it ourselves. Well, not so great.
What's fascinating to me about this is that in the run-up of the release of the Department of Justice investigation, which everybody anticipated was going to be bad for the police department, we at the City Hall Press Corps kept asking him, are you going to agree to a consent decree? Are you going to agree to a consent decree? And he wouldn't answer that question. And then on the day that the Department of Justice was in town and unveiled the report, he signed a legally binding document saying that he was going to negotiate a consent decree, and we all went, oh, that's a little bit of a surprise. He didn't have to do that, but he did. And then what's interesting is that Trump had already been elected. We knew that there was going to be a Trump administration, which was surprising, because if he was going to take the out that we thought that the Trump election
had
given
him,
that's when it was. But he didn't take that. And then for him to sort of, in the last couple of weeks say, well, we're never going to get a consent decree and it would be a waste of city resources to pursue one, has now sort of put him in this very odd position.
He's not following through with the things that he promised
opened himself up to charges that he reversed himself. And he's opened himself up to charges that he doesn't actually want to reform the police department, which I think is very problematic for him politically, because, he's only just now sort of emerging from the purgatory of the Laquan McDonald, scandal. And this threatens to sort of reignite that ire toward him.
And you see it already. I mean, lawsuits from organizations like Black Lives Matter, but a threat of a lawsuit from what should be considered a political ally, the Attorney General Lisa Madigan, who comes out and says, you said you were going to do this. You're going to do it. If you don't do it, I'm going to sue you. I mean, we were joking last night. I mean, that's kind of the fight we want to see is a Lisa Madigan, Rahm Emanuel. There's a lot of history there.
You got to wonder if she's thinking, maybe this mayor thing is not such a bad thing.
My dad's never going to retire, so yeah, I got to find
out. Right, and he always wanted to be mayor too, but he never really had the timing together on it. But there are other things that I wonder about it on this, and one of them is, does he gain somehow from the police? Is he going to think that he has police endorsement
out of
this?
I've heard the idea that there are definite voting blocks.
Yeah.
If you think about the Northwest side and the Southwest side and police, and they came out in force and voted against Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton, and you saw like the pockets of red mm-hmm. where police and fire live in the city of Chicago. So there might be a little bit of an olive branch to say, I can't, maybe I can't get reelected if I don't have these areas.
Right.
Or at a certain point, having a volatile relationship with police and the fire department, not a great thing for any mayor.
No.
Well, before I covered City Hall, I covered Jefferson Park, which is on the Northwest side, and it's home to many, many police officers and firefighters and city workers. And Emanuel was deeply unpopular in those neighborhoods, but Chuy Garcia never, completed the deal. He never sort of was seen as somebody who was a viable alternative. And the sense was, the devil we know, essentially, which is what I heard from a lot of people.
One thing that was interesting this week was that
Tony
Preckwinkle is not going to run the county board chair. And she, president rather, and she, was a viable alternative, mm-hmm. right? So that takes that.
And his name is thrown back in.
He wins. You can't beat somebody if you don't have somebody. And so you got to have a good candidate. And right now we're still wondering who that'll be.
I just wonder though, and someone just texted in, explain define consent decree, which is essentially a judge, a federal judge that would negotiate the terms and be you'd be responsible to a federal judge for the reforms moving forward.
So for example, if the city of Chicago and the Department of Justice agreed that every officer, for example, had to wear a body camera whenever they interacted with a member of the public, and then the independent monitor could, say, okay, well, unfortunately, 55% of police officers didn't activate their body camera when they were interacting with the public. The Department of Justice could then go to the judge and say, we want you to order the city to do a better job. And then eventually it could, sort of result in fines and that sort of thing.
And there's this really interesting, I find this story, I mean, it'd be worth talking more about on the show, just this, the give and take, because we've heard Jeff Sessions say he doesn't want consent decrees. doesn't believe they work, doesn't want the federal government involved in local police forces. It's the same sort of policy movement that the Trump administration has done. Then they've been very consistent with saying, we don't want the federal government involved in this stuff. That's state, it's local, you figure it out. And you wonder how much of the closed-door meetings that Donald Trump and Rahm Emanuel have had and how much conversations they've had where they said, listen, that's not going to happen. You're going to have to start thinking about different ways to play that. And how much of this is a political strategy for Mayor Rahm Emanuel?
Well, you know, I think he's in a very interesting position because, you know, his national profile has certainly risen in recent weeks as he's made more trips to groups to sort of explain sort of the national political, you know, phenomenon. And he loves doing that. He loves talking about national politics. But he has not been in any stretch of the imagination, a member of the resistance, as they call themselves. You know, he's been very much the let's work with him where we can work with him, let's oppose him where we have to oppose him, but let's not pick fights that we don't have to win, which I think is sort of not where sort of the Democratic Party yeah. is.
You know, and the other story this week that leads to the fact, you know, that we have him in the loser category was the property tax increases. But I also have that an overreported story because, frankly, when we were told about the property tax increase and all of us sort of felt it, we were told this was a yearly increase. Now I feel like they're going to be sort of picking shots at the mayor every time that, they, you know, you calculate that there's going to be an increase.
And
it goes with the territory.
That's why I said that. Yeah. That's right. That's what happens when you put it. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we will continue with losers here on The Download. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Ray Long, Heather Sharone in studio. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. All right, this is sort of a special area in which it's, I guess it's winners, losers, overreported, underreported. It's all the stories, and it's what's happening in Springfield. I mean, today, I mean, in the last 2 days, we've seen some big stories coming out. Most notably that we saw that the Illinois Department of Transportation said they're going to, if we don't have a budget in 15 days or 14 days now, they're shutting down all projects. Lotto said, the national Lotto said, you know what, Mega Millions and Powerball, Illinois can't play unless they have a budget. Governor Rauner says, all right, special session, which usually I would say, okay, that's great. Get back to work, get a budget done. But they had a budget proposal, and nobody moved on it. It sat in the House. It didn't even get called. The governor kind of had threats to veto it before, so they just didn't even So to me, it just seems futile in the way that you would go down there with this experience. I mean, where are we with this, Ray? I mean, is this something that is just political theater to call a special session at this point?
Well, right now, Rauner can say, I called everybody back. The Republicans have rolled out their plan, and if the Democrats don't accept his plan as he likes it, then he can say, well, the Democrats are not flexible. That's
so the Republicans are going to come back in special session with their own plan.
Right.
A plan for the
right.
It's the first time we'll see this because
right.
mostly it's been a plan for the Democrats that
right.
Republicans have.
And Rauner has said, hey, I'll sign this if it goes through like this. Although the problem is that there are still things in here that are not necessarily going to get through. So that gives him this kind of constant ability to reach out and say, you know, this is not what I want.
Heather, I mean, the plan that came out of the Senate was a balanced budget without the school stuff, which was attached, but a concept that even Democrats would say had Republican ideas in it. The big thing that Rauner had suggested that he wanted was a property tax freeze of 4 years. The Senate said, we'll give you one for two. It never got out of the House, and it never got to see if the governor was going to veto. If the Senate takes this plan, the Republican plan, but puts their stamp on it and says, we'll give you the 4-year deal, is this a done deal? I mean, is Governor Rauner, are we done? Are we back to being the best state in the union?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That property tax freeze is tough for some, you know, legislators to vote for because it's going to put really big pressure on local governments because you freeze that property tax, you limit cities and towns' ability to sort of, you know, pay for police and fire and all sorts, you know, of critical services. So I think that it's a tough vote, but I think that it's indicative of sort of where we are in Springfield, that we're talking about 2 years versus 4 years. And, you know, to a layperson, I think, okay, we'll just figure it out, you know, just, you know, get it done. You know, I'm just reminded of what Rahm Emanuel said about Bruce Rauner, is that, you know, everything is so difficult. You know, the mayor has said of the governor, and of course they were once good friends and, you know, vacationed together. But I think Ray is correct in that Rauner has in recent weeks moved the goalposts. You know, he's gotten something.
If I were the Democrats, I'd bluff on the idea of saying, okay, let's put that same budget through. We'll change the property taxes for 4 years. We'll take some pain on some of these municipalities, find different ways to help. But here you go. And see how he reacts to it. Ray, I got to ask you, you were a bureau chief down in Springfield for years. I mean, the idea that they are flying through deadlines and they just don't care anymore. I mean, there's this tension and there's this midnight deadline and it just doesn't happen. It just kind of blows my mind that they have no respect for the idea that there are these endpoints, these deadlines, these things that have been set up and adhered to throughout Illinois history.
Right. I think that this legislature, and I think many legislatures, you see it in the national level when they get a debt crisis or whatever, they need to raise the debt ceiling. They react best under pressure, but now they don't care about the pressure. And I think they're still shell-shocked here from the Blagojevich era, where he was calling them into special sessions, and I mean every month for a while there. And so they don't have the time to heal, for one thing, and they don't have the time to really get their act together to do anything constructive other than build up another mailer that they can send out to the other side during the election.
Special session, of course, before the end of the month. But, you know, are you at all optimistic as two journalists who've covered politics that this will be the session that brings together a balanced budget or at least a spending plan that will be a stopgap and continue the kicking the can down the road?
Well, I think John Cullerton said this week that he wasn't going to do a stopgap budget. You know, remember, they did a stopgap budget last year, so it kicked the can down the road for a while, and we're essentially no better off and significantly worse as a state than we were a year ago. I think the question is, you know, do school districts across the state have enough operating capital to open in the fall? Because I think if you see suburban districts not being able to open because they've had gotten those grants and they can't make ends meet, you know, that's where the pressure is going to,
that'll get
I
their
think,
attention. Yep.
You know, have to be. Because again, I think the deadlines, like Ray said, they have lost their sting. You know, it's like those deadlines are the parents who have said one too many times, if you do that again, you are going to your room, but they never follow through.
Heather Giron, Ray Long in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll continue the conversation reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thanks, David. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, we're reloading this week's news with Ray Long, the investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune, Heather Giron, City Hall reporter at DNA Info. We are now to the point where we start talking about underreported and what stories sucked us down the rabbit hole. Let's get into underreported. Heather, what do you got for that?
Today, the Trump administration announced they would take no immediate action to reverse the status granted to so-called Dreamers. Yeah. And those are people brought here by their parents before they were 16 under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA for short. And which is a major reversal of a campaign promise.
It feels like a reversal of a reversal. Like I said, at one point, didn't he say, Dreamers are off the table?
Well, he said that he would, you know, have a soft heart towards them because they were a lot of really great people. And of course, you know, Mayor Rahm Emanuel personally lobbied him not to take action against DACA students. A couple months ago, it seems like a couple years ago, the mayor had Dreamers over to his house for dinner. So it was a very public campaign. However, with everything with the Trump administration, the Homeland Security Secretary Kelly came out today and said, well, you shouldn't read anything into this statement. We're not taking any action now. It doesn't mean that we're not going to take action tomorrow or the next day or the day after that.
And Trump could tweet tomorrow.
Absolutely.
And it totally reverses again.
Yeah. You know, I that story is an interesting one because to me, that is what the big sort of liberal approach to immigration reform was with Obama. That was the big act that he did. I mean, you could make a strong argument, and a lot of people do, that he was not very liberal, Obama, when it came to immigration. Deportations were at the highest level they've ever been. But that was the one area that he said, we're going to do something about this. And he got consternation and criticism from the right to the point it became a campaign promise to reverse this. And at the end of the day, you know, it seems like maybe the president and looked at it and said, you know, yeah, this is actually pretty good.
I mean, it's important to note that, you know, the Trump administration has blocked the second part of what President Obama tried to do. He tried to grant legal status to the parents of arrivals so that the entire families would be protected.
That's what he blocked.
It was blocked by the Supreme Court. They tied four to four.
Right.
There was no decision. So a lower court decision stood that ended the program. And now that litigation is dead. The Trump administration is not going to ask the court to reinstate that.
I don't pay enough attention to immigration politics, and I want to do that. That's a New Year's resolution for 2017.
Write it down.
Halfway through. But I'm interested in where does conservative politics weigh in when it comes to Dreamers? Are they hardline, like unacceptable, the kids shouldn't be here as well? I mean, do you get that kind of vibe, or are they a little bit more kind of sign of the times, go with whatever the policy is?
Well, I think, you know, you have to look at Steve King of Iowa. He's sort of the furthest right of the right. And if you'll remember, a couple weeks ago, there was a Dreamer who was arrested and deported, and he posted a picture of a beer stein with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement logo on it and said, you know, basically, huzzah, good guys, you know, that's the first one, let's get the rest out of them. So there's clearly a sense that at least on some parts
there's
of
no
the Republicans that, you know, if you're here illegally, you're here illegally.
Okay.
But it's tough because they're kids, right? And I don't think it's a mistake that's, you know, where people like Rahm Emanuel sort of focus their energies.
Yeah, the compassion politics kind of come in at that point.
I think this is developing at the same time that Trump is also doing a hard right thing, right? He goes back and says, you know, blows up the Cuba policy that Obama had. So I think that that was done intentionally at the same time where they were moving.
Well, very
on
underreported.
Well, what's interesting, if you look at what Trump actually did on the Cuba policy today, is that he didn't actually really reverse.
Didn't do anything.
A lot of it. So, you know, I think that it's difficult for reporters to cover the Trump administration because he will give a big speech and put out a lot of tweets of, I did X. And then when you actually sort of, you know, a couple hours later, go back and you look at the text of the executive order or whatever it is that he's actually done, sometimes the rhetoric does not actually meet the
well,
road.
That's another area that I would like to do an hour on. I mean, it's so interesting. And I was listening today, and I think it was here on GN, about, you know, the military in Cuba and its connection to tourism and what we're actually giving money to and who's the oppressors. There's a lot in that that's very complicated when it comes to Cuba. So there is some concern, and the Trump administration is looking into that concern. But you're right. I mean, not much changed in what the process or what was already on paper. So we'll see how that plays out. But it's a very complicated story. I'd love to get into it. Ray, what do you got for underreported?
You know, when you have shootings on the 31st Street Beach, and there's two of them, I believe it was on Sunday, and it just happened, and then everybody moved on. And that is not something that we should be thinking about. But it also struck me this week that we also had shootings right down in the Loop on Michigan Avenue, and it just...
Stabbings on North Avenue
Beach. Yeah, it makes you wonder if areas that people thought were safe are less safe now.
Well, I mean, it's a story that is covered frequently about Chicago in the summer, and here comes the summer, and we saw on what would really the first sort of summer weekend last weekend a scene at 31st Street Beach that, I mean, is pulls a little bit at the heartstrings for anyone to mm-hmm. think that's a family area. There was a shooting. Mm-hmm. There were eyewitnesses, people grabbing their kids and running in different directions.
Right.
You know, I mean, a chaotic experience at a family beach over people using a gun.
I heard Superintendent Johnson say that essentially it was two knuckleheads who got into an argument over where somebody had put their cooler, and then, you know, they were armed and they started shooting. And it sort of brings us back to the very top of our discussion where, you know, somebody, you know, who has a gun, you know, gets angry and uses that gun. You know, it seems to be that there's no sort of, oh, wait, I'm around kids. Oh, wait, I'm around congressmen. There's no sort of that sort of thing that might have been there in the past to stop. It doesn't seem like it's stopping.
Yeah, we've spilled over from nasty rhetoric to nasty shootings.
Yeah. And I just read on the Tribune that there was a shooting today at a school picnic in Englewood and Pill Hill, and students that were caught up in that shooting were actually at the 31st Street Beach shooting. So it's the second shooting that some of them have been involved in, you know, less than a week.
The other story, I wouldn't put this under underreported, but it's definitely under rabbit hole as we kind of blend them together here. The story of Megyn Kelly interviewing Alex Jones. Alex Jones, the man behind InfoWars, alt-right kind of leader who has had a successful, really loyal following podcast and streaming show for years. Megyn Kelly goes over to NBC. She gets an exclusive with him. And then I'm not even sure what's happening. I mean, I guess the first was a backlash. Why would you put him on NBC? We don't like this guy. He's famous for suggesting that the Newtown shooting in Sandy Hook with the 20 children was a hoax. It was some sort of government conspiracy to take away your guns. That, he has said, has been blown out of proportion. And, you know, that's been spun out of, and that's not what he meant. But, you know, people have taken out of that. But he did say it. So there's a backlash that the actual television station in Connecticut is not going to air the program, which is on Sunday. And then, and Heather, this is where it gets really rabbit hole for me,
yes.
Where I'm like, so then it becomes that Alex Jones is not sure that Megyn Kelly's going to do a good job in explaining who he is, and it's a hit piece. So he's been recording her the entire time.
Yes. Secretly. Yeah, secretly. And of course, there's some question about whether those recordings were illegal, although Texas is a one-party consent recording state.
That's where he's at.
So, you know, so he's been dribbling out these recordings over the last couple of days, and it sort of reached a fever pitch today where, you know, he's recorded her sort of buttering him up, for lack of a better word, and promising to be fair. And, you know, Ray and I have done this, you know, more times than we'd care to admit. You know, you want somebody to talk to you, and they don't necessarily want to talk to you, and it's probably not in their best interest to talk to you. So your job as a journalist is to say, you know,
I'll be fair.
I will be fair.
That's all you're doing, is you're saying, I'll be
yes.
fair.
So the question is, did she go beyond I'll be fair and promise him, you know, that she will do a nice piece, that it will be a positive piece? And I think that's, you know, sort of where you have to draw the line. I think that I think also some of the problem, you know, is that, you know, this is sort of Megyn Kelly's second big show after jumping from Fox News to NBC. So
she did a Putin interview, right?
Right. So the question is, you know, do her fans come over from Fox News and support her against Alex Jones? Who do they pick in this fight? It's sort of this whole big, for lack of a better term,
well, I was. It's funny, right? Because I was ready to have an argument about whether or not NBC should air this interview, because there's been a lot of pushback, and we've seen this a lot. And I truly, you know, when this was earlier this week, when it came out that there was backlash to the interview, not to how it was set up, but the interview, my inkling would say there's no difference than, I mean, we've been doing Dateline shows on David Koresh and
right.
and other people. I'm not saying that that's where Alex Jones is at, but we've had right. people who are
controversial.
Yeah, the controversial Truly. Put on television. Yeah. To me, I feel like it's an overstep to say he can't be a right. subject of an interview.
Right. I think that you have the ability to go out there and do a story about somebody who's been controversial. I think that is a fair game. When you start promising, if there were promises, or saying that you were going to maybe bend the rules a little bit, then you then you have lost your objectivity.
Yeah.
And so you have to remember
now,
how
it
to
gets
hold
a little
the
bit
line.
More cloudy.
I mean, there's allegations that Megyn Kelly agreed to allow him to see the footage and to see what she was, you know, see the clips that she used of InfoWars. And that, I think, would be clearly unethical. You know, I don't give Rahm Emanuel a chance to rewrite his quotes, you know, just so he sounds smarter or better.
Right.
So that's problematic. And of course, you know, Megyn Kelly got her start as a lawyer here in Chicago. So,
well, Six Rio says alt-right, blah, blah, blah. No Republican takes Jones seriously. And I don't think any Democrat does, too. And I don't think that this is really a conversation about the middle. It's like, yeah, but I mean, it's a question of, you know, I think when to say to this texter, the idea that when you start putting fringe people on, I think there's pushback to whether or not those ideas are more in the tradition of what we know to be. I'm not saying this about Alex Jones, but the sort of what we see with white supremacists or neo-Nazis, do you put them on the air? Do you not put them on the air?
I think it's fair to expose people and let the truth come out and set you free, if you will. But it will be informative. And if there is this type of issue out there, Alex Jones is an issue, right? And there are others out there with lesser degree, then it's fair to examine that.
Yeah. The local story that I will wrap up my rabbit hole story is the story of the Chicago Sun-Times theater reviewer, Hedy Weiss. Hedy Weiss is under fire from some in the theater community. There's a petition that came out to say we're no longer going to give her comps. They want other theater companies to roll back comps based on what they say is a systemic career of being inconsistent with her opinions and her commentary. Some say it reaches over the line into racism, other areas. And they essentially, this all came out because of a Steppenwolf review in which she questioned the premise of a play that was about race and about, I think it was about a police shooting. And she was questioning kind of, I hate to say it, but it was like a sort of an All Lives Matter versus Black Lives Matter kind of debate. Anyway, there is this real pushback. And I know a lot of people on social media who I really respect, theater people who really weighed in on this. And they have made eloquent statements to how they have had a problem with this reviewer's work for years. And it's the one thing where right away, it's not unlike with the Alex Jones stuff, where I'm like, you know what? It's opinion. It's review. You don't like your reviews. That's usually par of the course for theater companies. You know, like as someone who has had a theater company, there are times you're like, I don't like that theater reviewer. Why? Well, I mean, they gave us a bad review, but still.
Well, it's fake news.
Right. But I mean, and then, you know, I thought it was really interesting because I and Pete can attest, we sat there one night, we went through the Facebook post, and there were so many posts. I'm like, this is a unanimous theater like community that is all angry. And then Robert Feeder put it in his post, and then you saw media crew that came to her defense in the way that they said, oh, these theater kids are so sensitive, they don't understand. She said such a great track record. A really interesting story about the role of a critic, a reviewer, and whether or not they're allowed to inject their worldview, their opinions, their commentary into somebody else's work.
And this is almost 95% of the reason why I'm not an opinion journalist, because it's a really delicate balance that I think you have to thread. You have to, you know, sort of accept the work on its own terms, but you're a human being and you're being paid to have an opinion about the work. I think it also, you know, I think brings up the need to have more diversity in newsrooms because, you know, obviously, you know, Heidi is going to have her, you know, sort of come at it from her own place as a woman. You know, I'm always struck by how different reporters with different life experiences come at the same story in a completely different way than I did.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that one is right or one is wrong or one is, you know, fake news and not fake news, but I think it is an interesting, you know, if nothing else, it should encourage people who run newsrooms to make sure that they are pulling from a wide,
especially in arts and culture, because as we evolve, especially in this Chicago theater scene where we have more voices of color and more diversity and more different thought put on stage to challenge the status quo. That's what the plays are doing. New play, you know, the ideas, they put an idea up on stage and there's a debate around it and they come to a conclusion or not, but the idea being that they're challenging their audiences. to have someone who they feel systemically says hogwash or, oh, that's not how the world works. I can understand why they may be like, all right, you know what? That's you're missing the point of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, I think this is one of those areas that you give people the freedom to have their opinion, right? You don't like their opinion? Well, you can not buy the paper or you can do what you want. But columnist here has her opinions and she can go out and give them. Now, if you see her consistently being something that you don't like or you disagree with her strongly, you can read Chris Jones in the Tribune.
Well, I mean, there's one thing for readers. I think that the theater community is saying they don't have a lot of outlets. Like, people are going to review shows and kind of come out, and we have to go through two papers in this town and maybe, you know, and the Reader or other places. Mm-hmm. But the idea being that the major newspapers drive the audiences mm-hmm. to come to seats. And if one is just not as consistently bashing the work that we're doing across the board, then people just think that it's bad. Ray Long, Heather Sharon, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and then we'll wrap it up. We'll do which story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 500 years from tonight. Stay with us. All right, we're reloading this week's news. Heather Sharon, Ray Long in studio. You guys were great tonight. Really
Thanks.
Appreciate you guys coming.
It's always
on a Friday
fun.
Night. I know it's a summer weekend. You guys got plans.
Oh, man.
We are very
the plan
in demand.
Is to be with you. Yeah.
Heather, you can read her stuff at DNA Info. She's the City Hall reporter there, and Ray is an investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. All right, so let's get to this. The story, which will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 500 years, there'll be... When we go back to cave dwelling in 500 years, they'll be writing up these stories in hieroglyphics on the walls. What do you got, Heather, for the story that'll be remembered from this week?
Well, 500 years, I can't even think about. But I think that this is a moment where potentially Chicago will look back and say we could have had real police reform and real changes. You know, Rahm Emanuel says a non-consent decree is as good as a consent decree. And I think that that will be the subject of much debate. Mm. And if it goes one way or if it goes the other way, I think could shape sort of whether actual changes to avoid a shooting like the death of Laquan McDonald, will happen.
Ray?
The whole Trump mess. I think that it's just the continuing saga here. And you hear things about the past, scandals and the Ulysses S. Grant administration, things like that. This will be kind of like us looking back at Grant and the Teapot Dome and all that kind of stuff.
I will say the Amazon Whole Foods story, I think that that'll change retail as we know it. But like you said, you're getting your organic produce delivered by drone. And I think I also think a very scary story about two major, major companies that control all of it and push the prices on suppliers. That's something to watch out for. The other story I'll say is the birth of Anthony Rizzo, the leadoff hitter. I think that he will become a Hall of Famer. He'll be the new Ricky Henderson. Yeah.
The Cubs hit the lottery when they got Rizzo and Bryant. Right? Yeah. I mean,
it's just amazing. He just goes to lead off and he hits home runs. So yeah, Heather, Ray, great to see you guys. Thanks for being here to reload this week's news. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you, man.